we go through three major ration changes a year: high wheat inclusion, no wheat inclusion, 50-50 wheat corn inclusion. And so those diets now are kind of more set with those fry matrix. So he's able to just go back and say, here's your ration when you get to the 1st of January that you ought to be feeding. So we've built more of a system.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/ag. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Welcome to the Seed Feed Science Podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm Carlos Campabal, dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions from the feed science and animal production industry. Please get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead in today's episode. So today, with a great pleasure, I have as a guest Mr. Matt Byers from AgriBeef, located in Washington, headquartered in Boise, Idaho. So Matt, welcome to the Feed Science Podcast.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Great. So Matt, I know the audience will be eager to learn a little bit more about yourself and what you do. And then, of course, part of your technical expertise on what you guys do there on the cattle performance and all that type of stuff. So why don't we get a little bit of a head start? Tell us a little bit about yourself, your career, and then we can jump into AgriBeef itself.
So I started in the cattle feeding industry in about 1996. I worked at a feed yard in Seminole, Texas, out in far west Texas. At that time, it was owned by a company called Cattleco, which doesn't exist anymore. Through a strange turn of events, I kind of started out there just working in the mill and then eventually in processing. And after a couple of years, enough people had quit that they pointed to me and said, why don't you manage it? So at the ripe old age of 26, I found myself managing a 32,000 head feed yard. I had one really great mentor and a guy named Bill Hamrick, who later went on to be the president of the Colorado Livestock Association. And he was very, very giving, taught me way more than I deserved to learn as a young guy that was probably a little bit too eager, and an older gentleman that was all too eager to let me continue to be eager. So some good things there. And then in 98, 99, I went to work for Continental Grain Company at that time at Cimarron Feeders in the panhandle of Oklahoma as the assistant manager of that yard. The reason for that change was at that time they were still marketing cattle live, and that was something that was of interest to me. And then in that Continental Grain structure, at the feed yard, we bought our own feeder cattle, bought our own commodities, all those kind of things, much more decentralized than was Calico at the time. So it was a good development opportunity for me. And that was a spot where I just got really, really fortunate again and found myself surrounded by a group of people about my same age that are still involved in the industry today and are some of my best friends. Ed Burr, John Foley, Ryan Morehouse, they're all very prominent guys in the industry today. So we got to work together as a team. We got to try a lot of new things. I got to really explore ourselves as managers and leaders. And so we stayed together there through some transitions. So Continental Grain became Conti Beef, which became Five Rivers Cattle Feeding, which eventually got bought by JBS. And that would have been in about 2005. So I managed a couple different yards. I managed at Cimarron, and then also was manager at Colorado Beef in Lamar, Colorado. Was assistant manager at Hartley Feeders, as well as the yard there at Cimarron. And then in 2005, I actually got called to the corporate office from the feed yard manager to be vice president of human resources for the new company. So the idea there at the time was that, you know, we kind of had this cultural merger that was going on between the Continental Grain feed yards. And at that time it would have been the Smithfield Beef Group feed yards, which were the old Monfort yards in Colorado and Idaho. And so they asked me to come up there and sort of lead this merger and on the people side of things. And that's where I got a lot into training and development and building winning culture, ideas, those kinds of things. So I did that for about a year by itself. And then in 2006, I got the operational responsibility. So all the feed yard managers reported to me as well. And we just carried on with that mission of developing a team, building a culture rooted in high performance. We did a lot of capital improvement projects on feed mills and those kinds of things from 2008 until 2013. 13, I left the company and I did some executive recruiting, headhunting for a couple of years, worked for Zoetis for a couple of years while I was finding myself. And then in 2017, I joined AgriBeef. So we left Colorado, went to Boise, and I joined AgriBeef just to be the head of their feed yard operations. I was intrigued by the model. One of the things that's very unique about AgriBeef is that we own and operate beef processing plants, two of them, one in Idaho, one in Washington. And then we also own and operate feed yards and a ranch in Washington as well. So we have a vertically integrated model. We have a powerful set of brands. We market direct to consumer through our e-commerce business, which is snakeriverfarms.com. And so it's a really unique company, smaller, and I thought it'd be fun. So I came up here to sort of finish out my career in the industry. And then in 2020, right on the heels of COVID, I got the president of AB Livestock job and started working on trying to get the business prepared for the future. And then in 2022, let go of a manager out here at Moses Lake. And it sort of highlighted one of the problems we have, which is not a very deep bench of people. So I found myself managing a feed yard again. So I'm kind of coming full circle. So still have the president of AB Livestock role, but then also showed up here every day since 2022 to kind of get things squared away at this feed yard. And today we're in a really good spot, have a really good team, not just at our feed yards, but also at our corporate office location. We do have a lot of that bench strength and depth that we've worked to build. And our feed yards are, you know, they're really performing at the best that they ever have in the history of the company. So we've kind of had, kind of at a high note you picked us at today. So
it seems that you have a very impressive career, you know, and I was kind of thinking in my mind, you kept like going north, starting Texas, you know, okay, Colorado, making your way all the way. And very interesting how you circle back and keeping that, you know, high admin position and at the same time running the feed yard, which I know is probably not everybody can do it. I'm pretty sure in that. And then, of course, for our audience, please like this on our podcast today. We really appreciate that, Matt. And you know, and so I see that very, very interesting overall. And, you know, we're a little bit, I know that the model you mentioned in AgriBeef kind of sounds very interesting as a vertical integrated from, you know, the ranch feed yard all the way. And I'm pretty sure you source your own ingredients a little bit in terms of that. And how does that look like? I mean, I know you have your processing facility, but how does that shapes how you handle your commodities, your ingredients for the feed itself? And how does that look like, especially where you guys are located?
So I'll start with, I got to start with the cattle, and that really goes to our brand. So we're a small packer. And so for us to compete in the beef space, it's through quality. So we really focus on high quality product. We have an American Wagyu product that's pretty well known, I think, in that space. And then we also have a number of other brands that would be choice and prime brands. And so for us, then when we come into the cattle side, we really focus on having the best quality animals in our feed yards that are going to produce that best quality product on the end. So Northwest genetics are phenomenal. And so we have the opportunity, and we're in the area where we can really get a lot of those cattle coming into our feed yards. We have a lot of relationship with ranchers and growers out in our general trade area. So we tend to get the same cattle year after year after year, and we kind of know how they're going to do, and we maintain these relationships. And then once they make their way into the feed yard, we've really focused on trying to keep our diets as local as we can. So whether it's through ownership of grain handling assets, which we do have, or through strategic partnership with players in our local area. We do things like feed wheat. There's a lot of wheat grown in this part of the country, so we steam flake wheat, and it accounts for, you know, on average, it'd be 50% of our grain inclusion, and so that's local. We've done things to build harvest corn programs because the corn works into the crop rotations for these farmers up here. You know, it's a different agricultural area than the High Plains. They can grow anything up here in the Columbia Basin. A lot of seed crops, a lot of vegetable crops, of course, apples, cherries, other fruits, wine, grapes. A very productive area, a lot of water availability through the Columbia Basin water project up here. So corn works into their rotation strategically in a potato or onion rotation. So they have to grow it about 3 years in rotation. And so they need a place to go with it. And where we really want to get the value out of that corn by steam flaking it, they would love to bring it as high moisture. And so we have kind of different programs that we use where we'll take in higher moisture grain and then just feed it through our flaker mills as quickly as we can and take advantage of the local corn crop that does get grown here. And so with all those things, we really made a press to what's available to us. So there's, you know, just as an example, there's wet distillers grain and dry distillers grain out in your part of the world. And in ours, we grow canola and crush canola out here. So we would feed a high-fat canola product that's crushed about 8 miles from where I'm at right now. We feed potato waste. So the everybody's favorite product on a feed yard tour out here is my French fry pile, because we have thousands and thousands of tons of waste French fries. So these are pre-fried fries that went into a bag and went into a freezer that reached the end of their shelf life, made their way back out of the bag and then onto a truck over to me. So they show up as a frozen product. And it's, you know, it's that whole idea that cattle are great upcyclers, and here's absolute food waste that would have gone to a landfill otherwise. And we turn it into delicious feed. The plant that we work directly with has the contract with Arby's. So they have, you see a lot of curly fries and spicy curly.
I was going to ask on that. They came out as curly, which will be very interesting, by the way.
And then the rest of the potato waste product comes as a slurry. So it's basically everything else. It's peels, it's cold hoe potatoes, it's wash water, it's all these things that is a very liquid product. And it works great for us as more of a ration conditioner. There's some energy in it, but it definitely adds moisture back into the diet. And so we, between all those things, we've been able to really keep our costs down and somewhat competitive, I would say, with the Midwest. And then with steam flaking for us is new in agribeef. It's within the last really 2 to 3 years. And so that's really been a help for us to get our feed conversions down as well. So we've become very competitive as cattle feeders in the last few years. And that's been exciting to the team here. And great for the company too.
And I was going to ask you there about the steam flaking. Of course, I personally have a little bit of a heart for it, you know, because here in Kansas is very common, of course, as you know, and all here in the plains. But it involves steam that I like to work with, and of course equipment, you know, but putting my hat here as a feed miller. But anyway, so tell us a little bit more about that. So you guys are flaking a little bit more just in the corn, or you guys also do other grains? I know you mentioned wheat a little bit there, which is a big commodity in Washington. I mean, compared to here to Kansas, is one of the top producers in wheat overall. So are you guys just focusing on that? And then besides that, you mentioned canola and everything. So it seems to me that a lot of your ingredients are locally sourced, I mean, within a range of miles, of course. So tell us a little bit about that, because I know that besides that, it could be a little bit more of an impact if you guys bring it, rail it, or truck it from farther away because of the cost of transportation.
So I got to go back a little bit. Our consultant nutritionist is Justin Sint, who's earned his PhD from your institution, actually, yeah, and did a lot of steam flake work while he was there. So it's also near and dear to his heart. And Justin and I have known each other for a long time, almost 20 years now. And so we're happy to have him as a part of the team, helping us bring steam flaking to our operations in the Northwest. And then just continue to challenge us about what we can do from a feed ingredient perspective. So he was the one that really helped us, I would say, get the wheat into the diet. And when we were dry rolling before, not as much value there. So we kind of kept corn in our diet as the primary source of grain, and we were dependent upon railed corn. So there are terminals out here. You know, we've got a couple of them pretty close. And so we were getting rail corn in, we'd have really high basis. And so once we switched over to the wheat, there's a local source available to us. I believe it's Whitman County is probably the largest wheat growing county in the country. And it's two counties away from here.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, really close to us. So there's a lot of, once you move out of the Columbia Basin project to the east of us, it turns to dryland wheat country really fast. And then similarly with potatoes, Grant County is the largest potato producing county in the country as well. So we do try to take advantage of what's available to us. And then I think for us, the main thing we've learned is if we've got wheat in that diet, we are going to like the cattle performance a lot more.
Oh, okay.
We predominantly feed steers at this location, and our performance has just been truly phenomenal. I don't want to say exact numbers, but they're really great. And, both from a gain and a conversion standpoint. And we think there's a little magic in the wheat, in having that in our diet. And so, we continue to keep that in. So we've kind of built a program around our harvests here, right? So when we get into July, we switch over to a really heavy wheat diet, July, August, September, start working our way into that heavy corn diet in October. And then we kind of run a 50-50 wheat corn. And so our dependency on rail corn has gone down tremendously. We've found local sources. There are a few guys around here that have their own bins for corn. And so we appreciate them as our neighbors and farmer friends that bring us that stuff locally as well. And so we just don't have the dependency on rail corn that we once did. And that helps us, you know, definitely helps us from a cost standpoint, but we do treat our neighbors like neighbors. So we really partner with them and try to, you know, not just make it a lopsided arrangement. We offer them an attractive basis to kind of put up with the nonsense of bringing your corn to a feed yard as opposed to a grain elevator or terminal. So we've done that. And then, like I said, the rest of the feed ingredients we source locally. We developed a silage program here with the same farmer partners that we have. So we feed, we were able to get these guys to double crop triticale and corn silage. So we've got a good program there for us as well on the roughage. So it's all just right here around us, and makes for not just a really good story, although it is one, but it makes for a really responsible way to run our business.
So great information there on the sourcing of ingredients, which, you know, like you said, you guys, I will call it blessed that you can locally source. And of course that put up a lot of very good cost reduction. And as I understand, which I'm very happy to hear, by the way, being from a wheat producing state, that wheat is help us there in the cattle performance overall. So anything when you guys, you were talking a little bit about the rotation, you know, wheat, corn, a mixture and others. Tell us a little bit about how that impacts your nutritional strategy on that. I know you guys have to be reformulating, or how does that work for you guys?
So that's where Justin earns his pay, because one of the things about, let's say French fries in particular, that's a variable ingredient. So as they create the waste, they bring it to us, and our obligation is to take all of it. So I think what we ended up doing is something that was kind of unique for us. We call it a fry matrix. So when he builds his formulations for us, it's a matrix. And so there's different inclusion rates of fries, because we don't want, you know, I don't want to call them and say, hey, they didn't bring us any fries, we need to reformulate. So that just lets us at the feed yard have that flexibility and say, hey, we need to drop our inclusion rate of French fries down to 4% as fed. And so we just change the ration, and we build these matrices to make it easier on him on the formulation side, and then also easier for us to make those adjustments on the fly. And that's just a part of our diet that we have an obligation to take that waste. And so when we do that, we just need to be able to reformulate on the fly. So it's different. It took us a minute to figure out how do we do this, because, you know, you call your nutritionist that doesn't want to build your ration, and we were calling them twice a day. Hey, we're out of fries. Hey, we got too many fries. So
yeah,
some of those kind of things. And so now we've got a pretty good system around that. And then really the rest of the ingredients, we found that stability. So like I said, we go through three major ration changes a year: high wheat inclusion, no wheat inclusion, 50-50 wheat corn inclusion. And so those diets now are kind of more set with those fry matrix. So he's able to just go back and say, here's your ration when you get to the 1st of January that you ought to be feeding. So we've built more of a system, and it used to not be that way, but it's that way today. Probably the thing too, I mentioned we didn't steam flake before, and we didn't. So we've done a lot of milling improvement projects as well. So bringing steam flaking in was brand new. So we've got brand new mills in all of our facilities today as well. So that's something I know a lot of the industry back in Southwest Kansas has been busy doing, rebuilding mills. And so we've done our fair share of that up here as well.
No, great. Great. Sounds very interesting. And on that sense. And so quick question. I think probably our audience will be curious. And before we go into that, for our audience, if you learned something new today, please share the video. We really appreciate it. So will that also have an impact? I'm pretty sure that the frying of those fries are very constant with the same amount of oil just to keep costs and things like that. But I don't know if they change type of oil. But if they do, I'm pretty sure it might have a little bit of effect going, let's say, soy or vegetable or canola oil. I mean, all those things are there, might have a little bit of an impact. I don't know about that, but it seems to me. But some experience on that, or is it pretty simple?
I'd say it's pretty simple. Now we would feed these northern cattle that we feed have, they can get some really significantly high intakes. And so we probably err to the side of caution and feed a little bit more roughage than some of our friends back in the high plains. We would feed a little extra silage in there kind of as a buffer for some of those things. But that said, we don't have a lot of digestive upset, not a lot of nutritional mortality. We don't have a lot of mortality, period. But we have a really good feeding weather up here, except for December to February. And it's really rough. Northwest is, we get a lot of moisture. It basically stays wet once we get to about Thanksgiving. And then we kind of break out of it about the first part of March. So winters are tough, but really nice weather in the spring and the fall. We get a few hot weeks in the summer when cattle will kind of back off feed. But the rest of the time, it's pretty mild, cools off in the evening, may get really hot during the daytime. And so we see pretty steady intakes. And as a result, we don't have a lot of digestive upset up here. So we've been able to get along really good with that variability in that product. And it's surprisingly, like as a Texan and the High Plains cattle feeder coming here, I looked at that potato waste and I was like, why do you guys do this? Why would you ever feed this garbage? And now I'm up here and I'm like, ah, that's pretty good feed, you know? So it's one of those things that has just changed. So yeah, it's pretty good feed. And we've just had to, you know, figure out how to create greater consistency, especially in that slurry product. So we mix it and we weren't doing that so much. So it's more, it used to be pretty non-homogeneous. So you'd get whole potatoes going through. And so now we've built a system that allows us to process that on a continual basis. And so if I showed it to you, it'd look like a chunky milkshake. And so that helps with the consistency of that product going into the feed. And so you don't see a lot of the things we used to see, which would be whole potatoes rolling out into the bunk or peels. Now you see this more homogenous. Like I said, it's more of a ration conditioner.
More consistency too.
Yes, for sure.
No, that's very interesting. And of course, our audience, please, if you have any questions for Matt, leave us a question in the comment section, and we'll be sure to let him know. So very interesting, everything that you mentioned, and that gets me triggered a little bit about the overall sustainability. And I'm not talking into the environmental perspective, more like the sustainability of the business, you know, because you guys source local, you know, you grow your silage, you have different programs there. I mean, I know Washington has very good weather, like you mentioned. Tell us how you see that in terms of overall and being competitors from your processing side too.
You know, I think, again, back to the uniqueness of agribeef, there's a percentage of our supply that we obviously produce directly for going through the plant. So it's more of a necessity up here. And one of the things that we've done really well, and so do our competitors in the neighborhood, is we've learned, I would say, in the Northwest how to how to basically take what really is a once a year calf crop and try and blend that with other sources of cattle that get us a steady supply going into these plants in the Northwest consistently around the year. And we're no different than our competitors up here and having how we figured out how to do that. But you know, I think the sustainability you talk about the business, I mean, obviously the packing segment across the industry is having a rough go. The feeding segment, the ranching segment has been doing really well. And for most of us, you know, it's just this offset. Cattle make money at the feed yard. Maybe the packing plant's not doing as well. And we see that across the board in the Northwest. And I don't think there's any uniqueness to any of the competitors up here in that space. So it's something that, you know, when if I put my packer hat on, which we have one of those too, it's like, man, I wish these cattle prices would go down, you know, to get margin back in that business. And then you're like, why would I ever wish for such a thing? So it's, you can find yourself a little manic when you think about how we operate this business up here. But yeah, it's an interesting dichotomy at this point anyway.
Yeah, I can see it balancing out, you know, and I think that's the benefit that you guys have. So what do you think about the current beef market on the consumer side? I mean, you see it steady based on your processing side, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, contrary to thoughts of current administration, you know, I think a lot of people think it needs to go higher. No, I'm just kidding. Beef prices are, and I'm going to speak more at an industry level rather than a company level, but I think most of us would probably say we're not going to get a lot of relief yet because this heifer retention seems to be going, and we probably see a little bit more high on cattle prices in the short run. What's that going to do to margin? Obviously, it depends on the sell side and where the consumer would be pushing back on higher beef prices if they choose to do that. So I think, you know, to me, I could probably say, well, your guess is as good as mine as to where beef prices go from here and where cattle prices go from here. And again, everything ties back into the general economy and the global economy about what's going on.
There's one idea.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very complicated puzzle. And I think a lot of people want to, you know, put a stake in the ground and say, I think beef's going to this or cattle's going to that. And I'm probably generally more of a mindset of saying, well, it's going to go where it's going to go. And what are we going to do to manage our way to a better outcome?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, there's no crystal ball, you know, so better be prepared to adjust. So for our audience, please visit our site, wisenetics.com, and learn more about all the other podcast segments like we have. Besides the feed science, we do have one in poultry, swine, dairy, beef, of course, that relates to this too, and pet food. So
it's time for our famous three.
You already know that the key to a profitable operation is healthy, productive animals. This starts with the quality and safety of your production inputs. Our team of experts at Kemin are driven by curiosity to develop science-backed ingredients and solutions to help you maintain feed and water quality, improve intestinal health, optimize nutrition, and eliminate pathogens. Learn more today by diving in at Kemin.com/ag.
Matt, we're coming here to the end of the time, and I think there's great information that you have shared with us, a very unique setup you guys have, and of course, learning how beef cattle operations happen in the Northwest here in the United States, and I think the audience will definitely appreciate that. So, quick question that our audience will be interested to know, when you're trying to find resources for information or something to learn about what's going on, where do you look for those type of stuff? What do you recommend somebody that might not be knowledgeable that much in the industry to look for information?
You know, probably the same place all your young viewers and listeners go to, ChatGPT. I'm not sure where else you go these days, but you know, I think I'm in my mid-50s, and so I still lean a lot on industry colleagues, probably more than anything. When I have a question, I talk to my nutritionist or guys that I've worked with in the past, or you know, people that I consider to be highly knowledgeable in the field, our consultant veterinarian. They'll point me to research oftentimes, and if we go look at studies, we would learn something there. We do a lot of research as well. So we do a lot of studies on our own to try and go learn what we can about whether it's new products or practices. We will we'll test these things about continuously. And so that's probably what I would tell you as far as like going to a periodical. That's probably not my go-to. My go-to is go after the knowledge and the wisdom that exists in the industry, and there's plenty of it out there.
No, I agree with that. Yeah, that's great feedback. And to finalize, I know you've been working in this industry for several years there, and also high positions, including in the HR business and side of things. And what would you recommend for a young professional starting their career, you know, this beef cattle industry or any other in the feed, to be successful? You know, those either somebody in college or just working their way up in a company. What do you recommend them? I mean, to do.
I have some young people on my team here, quite a few of them, and they're great. And I love them. They'd be the ones that encourage me to get on a podcast. So
great.
I would tell you that they're a joy to work with, and they help keep my perspective fresh. And I'll tell your listeners the same thing that I would tell them, which is that it's been a career that's been built around focus on the human element of the business. And so I joke with them, it's not a joke, it's real life, but I'll tell them the next time somebody does what I tell them to do will be the first time. So it'd be a surprise to me as much as it would be to them that they would follow an instruction. And so really it's more been about how do we influence people to do the things that we need them to do? How do we get them to the same spot or decision or whatever that we're at? And so when I think about what that is for somebody to be successful, I think there's a lot of balance. As managers, you got to have a lot of attention to detail. You have to pay attention to a lot of the details, but you also have to balance that with a willingness to kind of let go. So if I'm working with young people, I need to give them freedom to try things. Same way I did when I was younger as well, right? It's like I got to balance that. I've got to give them the authority and responsibility to go try new things and let them explore the world on their own. I still have to have the attention and the detail on the balance side of that. The other thing I talk to my people here about this a lot. You've got to continually seek to change. So whether you call that continuous improvement, but you've got to find ways to continually get better, and you've got to spend time almost on a daily basis doing this. But at the same time, you've got to honor what you know, the wisdom that exists in the industry. And there's certain things out there that you're like, hey, don't ever change this. Don't ever mess with this. We know this to be the case. And it's kind of that idea that there's nothing new under the sun, which is true. But then there's also things out there that we haven't quite explored, things that we can take from other industries and put to work in our own. And then the final thing is, and it tends to be one of the harder ones, is to, you know, to try and teach people to lead from a position of vulnerability, that I'm sorry are acceptable words to be uttered in the workplace. If you make a mistake, it's my fault is the same way. And then a continual press on yourself to improve yourself and try and get better. And all that, again, balanced with the need as managers that we still have to help people be accountable to adhering to our company values or guiding principles, whatever you have, and also achieving the mission. So there's this balance of, you know, I have to be vulnerable and let people know I make mistakes. And at the same time, I've got to help them be accountable to when they make mistakes. And I've got to do the same thing for myself. So if I were hitting three, those are the ones that I would say for 30 years, pretty consistent. We need to do that all the time. And those are kind of the core tenets that I don't think have changed very much over time. So,
no, great. I think those three core are great. And I'm pretty sure our audience will definitely benefit a lot to understand and apply them. I was like, even like here taking notes, because one of my favorite questions to add people when I host them is to get that wisdom, you know, so I appreciate that a lot. So with that, Matt, this concludes the Feed Science podcast, and we really appreciate you being here. Thank you very much for your participation and also your young guys. I encourage you to be part of this. So thank them too. So with that, this concludes another episode of the Feed Science podcast presented to you by Wisenetics. Thank you, our audience, for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on any other future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. Your feedback is very valuable with us. Until next time, this is Carlos Campabadal from Kansas State University, hosting for the Feed Science Podcast, signing off. Thank you very much.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.